Welcome to Savor. This is Kelly Hines, registered dietitian.
And I'm Danielle Beck-Ellsworth, a licensed marriage and family therapist. Today, we're going to dispel the myth that eating disorders only occur among adolescents and young adults. And here to provide us with the facts about eating disorders among adult women is Dr. Margot Main. So thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
My pleasure and my privilege. I'm glad to be here.
I have to let you know that I have been a fan of your work for a while, since my undergraduate. And so it's really very special that we get to interview you. I was so excited when you agreed to share your time with us. So thank you very much.
You're welcome.
So I'm going to introduce our listeners to Dr. Main. She is a founder and advisor of the National Eating Disorders Association and founding fellow of the Academy for Eating Disorders. She's the author of Treatment of Eating Disorders, Bridging the Research Practice Gap, Effective Clinical Practice in the Treatment of Eating Disorders, The Body Myth, Father Hunger, and Body Wars. She's also senior editor of Eating Disorders, the Journal of Treatment and Prevention. Her newest book, Pursuing Perfection, Eating Disorders, Body Myths, and Women at Midlife and Beyond. Dr. Main is the 2007 recipient of the Laurie Irving Award for Excellence in Eating Disorder Awareness and Prevention and the 2015 recipient of the NIDA Lifetime Achievement Award. She lectures nationally and internationally on eating disorders, female development, and women's health, and she advocates for improved prevention and access to care for eating disorders through her work for the National Eating Disorder Association. Dr. Main maintains a private practice at Main and Weinstein Specialty Group in West Hartford, Connecticut. So, very impressive.
Thanks, Danielle.
Yeah.
So, you know, one of the reasons that we invited Dr. Main to speak with us today, because she obviously is an expert, but also she has been putting information out there about eating disorders in middle life or older adults. And we're really lucky because our listeners are so wonderful, and you all keep sending us emails and feedback and questions, and we're really happy about that because then we know that our podcasts are relevant to what it is that you need. And so we had an email from a listener who is 43 years old, and she shared with us that she had an eating disorder, anorexia, when she was in her teens, and she completed an inpatient program. And then she had one major relapse when she was 24. And like we often hear, there are what she calls lingering eating disorder symptoms throughout her life, and that she's not really happy with the place she is in recovery, and she's definitely reached out for help throughout the years. She went to a therapist last year who told her that she wanted to use her case for consultation, specifically stating, "You don't look like someone with an eating disorder." And I know Dr. Main's going to address that today because that's something we hear all the time, and it's just so minimizing, and I think one of the barriers that keeps our clients and people who are struggling from getting help. And so she went on to say that she's actually overweight now, and she knows that that is probably related to some of the metabolic damage that she's done over years of restricting, which we'll probably talk about today too. And that she finds that as long as she's able to engage in the patterns that have helped her anxiety around of this all over the years, exercise specifically for her and eating healthy, then she's able to manage her obsessiveness. But as we often see in older adults, the disorder really takes its toll on the body. And so she's starting to have injuries and things that don't allow her to engage in those activities. And now she's finding that she's having a hard time controlling her anxiety and the other things that she controlled with her eating disorder. So in reaching out for support, besides the horrible experience she had with her therapist, she's also been to support groups and ANAD and EDA and things like that, and finding that it's really hard for her because a lot of those are filled with younger women, and so she doesn't really fit in. And so what she was wondering is if we could talk about any writing or research or places for people who are older or middle-aged to actually find the support and the treatment they need. and what really are the best ways to address the lingering symptoms that she's feeling. So I know that's kind of a lengthy explanation of what's going on, but I think we need to know exactly what's happening out there. And I know that Dr. Main will definitely be able to help us with this. So great. Thank you again for being here.
So did anything sound familiar in that email? Anything pop
yes.
out?
Every single word. When I read it earlier, it is the whole story of eating disorders at midlife and later. You don't look like you have an eating disorder because we believe that the people with eating disorders are young women, high school, college age. They're thin. You can't possibly have an average body or an above average body and have an eating disorder. It just doesn't work. And you shouldn't be over 20 or 25 and have an eating disorder. There are so many women who do not get help from their physicians and their other healthcare providers and from otherwise good therapists because of the old biases we have about who gets eating disorders. In reality, 13% of women over 50 actually have eating disorder symptoms, according to a broad population-based study a couple of years ago in 2012. 13%. 12.4% have breast cancer. So we have more adult women with eating disorder symptoms than breast cancer. Wow. And yet we don't hear about eating disorders in adult women. It's like an invisible problem. We are talking about the most invisible women in our culture. So her experience is not that different. And I applaud her for trying to get help over the years and not giving up. But we need more clinicians willing to look at the broader spectrum of eating disorders. What I see in my adult patients is I have some women who are kind of straight anorexic out of the book, and I have some who are straight bulimic out of the book. But most of my patients have OSFED, other specified food and eating disorders, or they have subclinical eating disorders, or they kind of move in and out of different symptomatology. So it's hard to describe them as just one thing. But they really still have the preoccupation with their bodies and a very painful relationship with food, and they use food in their bodies as a way of managing anxiety, as she talked about. As they go along in life, there are new challenges in adult life that will put them face to face with body image issues again, and often that will be the time that the eating disorder resurfaces or intensifies, or they may not develop full symptoms, but they'll be in a great deal of pain, and you know, they will be struggling more at those times. One of the things about women's bodies is that they change over time, and we're supposed to change over time. We're not supposed to look like we're 18 when we're 38 or 48 or 58 or 65 or whatever age we are. Mm-hmm. We are supposed to change, and part of that change is that we gain weight. Every menstrual cycle a woman has, there's a weight gain associated with it, and then a weight loss perhaps. Every fertility issue, every pregnancy, and menopause are associated with weight gain. And as we get older, that's just a fact of life. But we're so engaged in this war on obesity that women continue to struggle with just a natural aging body. So here's this woman, she's getting a little bit older, and she's managed some of her anxiety about her body and about life through exercise. And, you know, she might be having some joint pain. She might be developing something like arthritis or something like that, and her body isn't able to do the old movement, and she becomes more anxious, more upset about her body. Instead of being able to accept that my body's changing, maybe I have to find a different kind of exercise that isn't going to be stressful, or maybe I need to find no exercise. Mm-hmm. But it's a very, very difficult transition for women to make as we get older. She mentioned that the therapist she went to talked about she would use her as a case, and that really, you know, that's not a compliment. We need therapists to get into this with patients with eating disorders and start talking about what it really feels like to be in that body, to really understand what it feels like inside that woman's body and inside that woman's head. We have to start allowing women to talk about the narrative of their lives as they get older.
Mm-hmm. That was something when I read Body Myth that I hadn't thought about before, but all the adult developmental stages that people go through, because we hear a lot about childhood development, but not as much about adult development. And we are still going through these transitional milestones, and it can be a struggle. And then, as you were mentioning, if you add in the body changes that happen at these stages, then it definitely can put someone at risk for an eating disorder.
And those developmental transitions, you know, when we're younger, there's like rites of passage, there's parties, there's gifts, there's acknowledgement that you're moving from middle school into high school, that you're getting confirmed, that you're having a bar mitzvah, that you're leaving college, that you're getting married. There's all these rituals where people recognize and support you through those life stages. But what happens as we develop into older ages, and when I say older, I mean like post-college, basically, is that there are no rituals, there's no recognition of this new life stage that you're in. And women are constantly going through developmental transitions. A woman, you know, gets married or makes another life choice in terms of developing a partnership with another person. That's a new life stage that brings some new challenges with it. If she decides to have children or have fertility treatment or whatever, that's another whole set of things. Working and being in the workplace as a woman is very different than it is for a man. We confront body issues all the time. We have to look really, we have to look a little sexy, but not too sexy. We have to look fashionable, but not too fashionable. We have to play that role very, very well. So we have to put a lot of energy into that. When women go through having children and then having the kids grow up, then what does that mean about their bodies? I know a lot of women who are now grandmothers and love the idea about being a grandmother, but they don't want to look like a grandmother. Mm. Women who go through marital separations and divorces and things like that, each one of these life stages has new tasks involved in it, and each of those also makes her confront her body again. So there's no support, no recognition for this new life stage, and women just keep on adding responsibilities. One of the things that women do as they get older is take on responsibility for their aging parents or aging aunts and uncles or aging neighbors. and so they're doing all of their own family care, and they're taking care of other people as well, and usually having a pretty important job outside the family, and all of that with no real support and no place to go other mm-hmm. than keep on doing more and keep on looking good while you're doing it. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. It's a lot of pressure.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Do you find, you know, as our listener who wrote us was saying that, you know, she, which was really brave of her to share her story and come forward, do you find that other older adult women aren't seeking help, aren't coming forward, you know, and that could be an aspect of what she's saying here too. She goes to these support groups and they're full of young people, and, you know, if she had gone to a higher level of care, she probably would have been in that same boat.
Right.
Is our older women who are struggling with eating disorders, are they not identifying it as an eating disorder and then not seeking help, or is there more just shame and embarrassment about it?
I think the shame and the embarrassment are the biggest obstacle to getting in the door of help. But the other obstacle is just what we're talking about, that clinicians and medical providers not understanding this at all. So there's no real invitation in. And one of the reasons I wrote The Body Myth many years ago it had to do with the number of women who were coming who had long-term relationships with primary care physicians who they trusted, but the physician never asked them anything about the 20-pound weight loss or, you know, the changes that they were going through in their physical appearance, et cetera, when these women had very active eating disorders. So a lot of women do want to get recognized, but when they go into a physician and they've lost 20 pounds in the past year because they have active eating disorder symptoms, restricting, purging, running marathons, whatever they're doing, and usually the combination of all of the above, and the physician doesn't recognize it, doesn't ask a question other than, how did you lose the weight?
Right.
One of my patients that really stimulated my thoughts about we need to talk and write about this more is a woman who had a long-term eating disorder. She had developed it, well, Her parents had brought her to Weight Watchers when she was 12 years old. She was going through a normal physical change, getting a little bit of weight on her, getting ready for puberty, but that didn't feel right to her parents, so they started bringing her to Weight Watchers at the age of 12. That was her early adolescence, through adolescence. In college, she lost some weight, developed some anorexia, kind of got better on her own. It was never recognized by her family. Post-college, achieved many things, had a couple of master's degrees, got married, had two children, and after the second pregnancy, developed very severe bulimia. She had these eating disorder symptoms the entire time, but developed severe bulimia for 9 years before she decided she needed to do something about it. So she went to her physician, thinking that maybe she could talk to him about it. This is the only person she thought she could go to. And when she went to the physician's office, the staff asked her how she lost the weight that she'd lost in the last year. She'd lost 20 to 25 pounds. And she was ready for that, but she wasn't ready for the physician to walk in the office and say to her, "How does your husband like your new body?"
Oh my gosh.
So this was a woman who was so embarrassed about having a problem. She's one of those women who just always does for others and never needs anybody to do anything for her. And she really needed this doctor to understand her. Mm. And so she didn't say anything. She was too embarrassed. And she left feeling like she was going to have a life sentence to this disorder that she didn't even understand. Fortunately, she went on the internet and she found my name, and she was only a few towns away and entered treatment with me. But that's the experience of many, many women, that this is treated as a cosmetic issue. Mm. And she was very severe. She had lab abnormalities and all kinds of things. She's done very well in outpatient treatment, but the shame first and the lack of recognition once you get in the door second keeps women from getting help. And then occasionally when they do go, they will find themselves often in groups with younger women. And I know a lot of people who run treatment centers who would love to develop a program that was more for adult women. But the other thing that comes with adult women's lives is all the responsibilities they have.
Right. That's really what I was thinking.
Really difficult to go away for residential treatment because you've got a job, you've got a mortgage to pay, everything else. You've got kids whose lives depend on you. You've got a relationship or two. You've got other people depending on you. How do you extract yourself from that, get someone to take care of all those details in your life for whatever length of time, whether it's 3 weeks or 3 months? And how do you do that as an adult woman? It's very difficult to have those resources. So what we need is a lot more outpatient programs. And we need eating disorder specialists across this country to start stepping up to this and developing, even if they only have a group of three people, developing outpatient groups where women can come and start talking about their eating disorders and not keeping them in the closet. This is a huge public health problem. 13% of adult women over 50 have eating disorder symptoms. Wow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right. And we have every single sort of research and support group and walks across the nation for breast cancer and entire wards of every single hospital. Yes. And we don't have any of that for eating disorders.
Right. We do have, the National Eating Disorders Association does a lot of activism. And they, of course, recognize adult eating disorders, but we need to do a lot more. We need to get it into people's offices and awareness. And we need to do a lot of education with physicians because they're often the place where a woman will start. She doesn't know who are the mental health providers in town. She doesn't know the eating disorder resources. So that is the place she's likely to go. Right. But she's also unlikely to go sometimes because of all the focus on weight. I can't tell you how many of my adult patients, to get them to go to the doctor to have a routine physical, to have some things, checked on that are part and parcel of an eating disorder, is very difficult because they don't want the comments about their weight. They don't want to know whether their weight went up or down or stayed the same. And they don't want to be treated just like a number on the scale.
Mm-hmm. And I would like to take a minute on that subject that isn't it's not even specific to middle-aged or older women. It's specific to every single person that goes to the doctor, that if you don't want to get weighed, you don't have to get weighed. Mm-hmm. So you can always just say, I do not want to be weighed today.
Yeah.
And people don't realize that they have that right. But if that's the thing that's keeping you out of the doctor, then that's important to remember.
That's one of the things I always say at an initial appointment with an adult woman who is reluctant to go to a physician. I offer to call the doctor, speak to the doctor or the medical assistant, and tell them that she's started treatment for eating disorder and she does not need to be weighed at this time. And they always will cooperate. It's mm-hmm. very rare that a physician won't cooperate with that. But I think that's an example of how ashamed women are to admit even that need.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. So, I mean, and the other thing, which is, you know, just a huge topic, and we address it on our podcast, and we talk about it amongst ourselves as the eating disorder community, but, I mean, yes, we do have NEDA, National Eating Disorders Association, but who knows about that besides the people in our community? You know, people just don't know that those resources are out there. And then even I think our listener mentioned that, you know, back in the 80s, she had an eating disorder. And back in the 80s, what was there? There wasn't much of anything for eating disorders. And so even for those people now to know, boy, this whole entire thing has changed. And unless they're seeking it out and looking online and researching it themselves, they really might not know that there are resources.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. And sometimes for those of us who are in the field, like the three of us, we can get immune to that. But in fact, it really is very difficult for people to know where the resources are. And maybe it isn't all that different from back in the 80s when I was treating eating disorders way back then. I've been around for a long time. And maybe in some ways it isn't all that different despite all the work we have done. We need to integrate much more into the mental health community and into the medical community. And it's almost like eating disorders are seen as separate and different, and they're not. I mean, they affect every system in the body. And they're so serious, and there's so many of them.
Mm-hmm.
I was actually going to ask you about that, Dr. Main, because you have been treating eating disorders for so long. And if I remember correctly, at one of the talks I've seen you give at a conference, you had mentioned that I believe you did your dissertation on eating disorders. And when you were proposing this topic, I don't know if it was the people on your chair, they were saying, you know, why do you want to study that? It's just going to be a phase. But you were already anticipating that this wasn't a phase and that this was, you know, going to spread and going to be a real problem. And I was curious, how did you know at that time that it was going to be as big as it's become?
Well, that's a good question. I just had the sense that what women were facing as our lives were beginning to change back in the late 70s and early 80s, that the increased pressure on us across the board and the increased pressure on us regarding appearance and weight and creating a certain image and the perfection that we were expected to meet in all areas of our life that was just starting back then, but each year has gotten worse and worse. I just had the sense that what we were seeing was not isolated cases of young women who were dabbling in eating disorders, but that this was really going to continue. And it is true that the people who supervised me and were my mentors all said to me, not one of them thought I should specialize in eating disorders. Mm-hmm. They all said to me, this is just a phase. And what are you going to do in a couple of years? Well, look, it's like 35 years later.
Right.
I've got plenty to do.
Yeah.
And I'm sorry in many ways that I was right, because I've seen so much suffering, as have you and many of the people listening to us today. But we can't walk away from this. Women are struggling to try to be everything to everybody. And in the midst of this, you know, we believe we have to have these perfect bodies, and these perfect bodies are not natural bodies. They're not bodies that listen to themselves. We don't eat intuitively. We don't do anything intuitively. It's all about trying to create an image that we believe will meet the standard for women today. So I wish I had been wrong about this, but and yes, my research as a doctoral student, I was very lucky when I got to the point of dissertations. My faculty advisor said to me, you should do something that you really love, because dissertations take a lot of time and energy. And all my life, I had heard about how horrible dissertations were and how painful they were. Mm-hmm. And this professor saying to me, you should do something you love, was like, what's wrong with you? But I did. I decided to interview women who were recovered. At that point, most of them were anorexic that I interviewed. And it just gave me a view of women's lives that just opened up so much to me. Most of these women had gotten some treatment, and it wasn't good treatment. And it was, I was collecting my data back in the early 80s, so it was way before what we do today, which I think we've come a long way. But many of them found that their treatment didn't help them at all. What really helped them was friendships and relationships outside of treatment. And I think that still holds to today, when we hear so many women having experiences where they don't feel understood because their problems as an adult woman are just not recognized. But that, my dissertation did give me a real window onto the complexity and how these eating disorders will continue in different ways throughout a woman's life. She might not have full anorexia or bulimia, but she still is struggling with the ongoing issues.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Listening to you talk about your research and sort of predicting that in the future this is going to be a problem, and you were noticing the changes that women were going through, and that you could see this wasn't just going to be a fad, it was going to be a major public health problem. I wonder, because there's a new school of thought, or newer, I don't know how new, that eating disorders are very much just biological and just genetic, and, you know, what do you think about that?
Well, I take a biopsychosocial perspective, and if you very concretely look at the number of letters in the word biopsychosocial, you find that bio is only three letters. Social is a whole bunch more. So that's just a concrete way of looking at it. I do believe that we have biogenetic predispositions, and there is some research about the genetic contributions to eating disorders. It's more based in anorexia than in bulimia. But even the people who do the genetic research tell us that genes, that DNA, codes for risk, but not for specific disease. So it isn't that your genes cause you to develop anorexia or bulimia. It is that it creates some risk and other things happen. Well, where do they happen? They happen in your environment, your psychosocial, milieu. So I know that there is a piece that is genetics, but the bigger piece is the psychosocial environment, and what I see as the multi-generational contributions to our relationship to food and to our bodies. That's really what it's all about. The other piece of the biology, though, is that once you have an eating disorder, there are biological changes that happen, as this woman wrote about when she wrote into you that she is higher in her weight than she expected to be as an adult, probably because of the years of restricting that have changed her metabolic processes and her endocrinological functioning, so that her body is affected by all of that. So biology is in there, and we have to certainly medically monitor our patients and be sure that there isn't any other illness causing any of the symptoms, but it's a smaller piece of the causes or the risk factors, I believe.
I agree.
And how do you like it? It's only three letters.
That's a great. Yeah. I like that. I won't forget that. You've touched on this, but out of experience, I find, I mean, because we are seeing then the people who have been brave and stood up and said, I need help, I have a problem. You know, we're seeing those people. And there are many of them out there that aren't saying that, and maybe they're listening to us. Maybe not. But I think the most difficult thing for me practicing with people who are midlife or older are what you were speaking about with, we have so many responsibilities. And how do I take time away for treatment, even if it's just an hour to come visit you in your outpatient office? And I find that that's the biggest stumbling block for my patients personally. And then I think the second thing I find is that sort of denial of, hey, I made it this far,
and nothing terrible has happened yet. And if I just do it every once in a while, does it matter? And my doctor's not saying anything. So, I mean, that's real. It's very real.
Yeah, I agree with you. And the fact that they have dabbled in it for years makes them feel that they have control over it. Many of them will say to me, no, I've got this. I can do it. You know, your other patients, maybe they have side effects. I can do this. And, you know, what I know from clinical experience and from reading as well is that with eating disorders, the body makes a lot of adaptations for a long period of time. But then there's one day that comes that the body just says, no mas, I can't do this anymore. Mm-hmm. And it is for women that happens, you know, it's usually in their 40s or 50s, but it can be later. So that it takes a lot of abuse, and then there's just a point.
Right.
We certainly see the same thing in substance abuse.
Yes.
So that feeling that I can do this, even though other people can't, is a big one. The other issue you brought up is, you know, how do I walk away from my family and everyone who needs me? How do I say that I have a need? Most of the adult women I treat they take care of other people and they do it really, really well, magically. You know, they're baking for their kids' school and they're bringing birthday presents to people at work and they're doing all these things all the time that they never get any recognition for. And the idea that they need something is just a foreign idea. They are the ones who take care of the universe. So that's foreign. The idea that they have a problem is foreign also. And I've had a number of my adult patients who get into treatment and do treatment really well, but they won't involve their spouse because they don't want to be seen as imperfect. Mm-hmm. They don't want to be really known in that way. I think the pressure on women to be perfect and to need nothing is huge and keeps them stuck in these patterns. And the rituals of exercise abuse and of restricted eating and even of binging and purging are the things that they use in these times of trouble because they can't use relationships.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And this isn't just Western culture. I know in some of your writings you were talking about cross-culturally we're seeing the same thing.
It's amazing what we're seeing. There was a really good article done just about a year ago. And in early 2001, I believe, Richard Gordon had identified that there were eating disorders now in 41 countries, you know, that we had globalized to 41 countries. But this recent research shows that we are pretty much everywhere. We're in Arab countries, we're in Asian countries that we've never been before, we're in all the European countries. We are in third world nations, we're everywhere.
Jeez.
And there is no protection anymore from eating disorders. You know, modernization and urbanization bring with it a whole different relationship to women's bodies, to food production, and to a sedentary lifestyle. It's this whole package. It's not just you get the internet. You get everything. And so it is truly, truly globalized. We don't have a lot of numbers from all of those countries, but there are some studies that are showing equal representation in, like, China and Japan as in Western nations, and a very rapid increase in the Arab nations. We're not going to hear much about that because literally those problems are covered up. But it is a deep concern. So we as a country have a responsibility not only to solve this problem in this culture, but also to solve it for the worldwide, because we have created it worldwide. We've exported it.
I'm wondering too, you know, do you have a different treatment approach for your patients who are in midlife or older who are dealing with all of these issues that we're talking about today?
Well, I wouldn't say I have a different treatment approach, but I certainly am aware of how important it is for me to be on an equal footing with that woman. You know, you both have referred to me as an expert, and I guess I am. Although the more expert I get in other people's eyes, the less expert I sometimes feel, because I realize the complexity of what we're dealing with every day. But when I meet a patient for the first time, I often say to them, I'm an expert about eating disorders, and that's why you're here, but you're the expert about you. And together we can do something. Alone, neither of us can do anything. But mm-hmm. together we can do something. What I want to do from the very beginning with an adult woman is give her a different treatment experience. You are not, you know, you are not a number on the scale to me. You're not a blob of protoplasm to me. You are a real person who has a lot of strengths, a lot of self-knowledge, and I'm going to learn from you. Yes, you're going to learn from me, but I need you equally present. So I'm much more aware of having that discussion early on with an adult patient, but I try to treat all of my patients with a lot of respect. And I was trained, as most people are, in the medical model, which is very much, you got a problem, we got a solution. Often the solution is a medication, but as a feminist, I have really adopted what is called the relational cultural approach to eating disorders, a very relational based model where we spend a lot of time just building the relationship and building trust. And instead of the medical model, which is very much a power over model, it's a power with model. I'm not going to be telling people just what to do. I'm going to be explaining why she needs to do something differently and help her to figure out what's getting in the way of that happening. So power with versus power over. I think with adult women, having the opportunity to talk about these issues and talk about their bodies with someone who treats them with respect is really important, because a lot of times they don't feel respected, they don't feel listened to, and they feel like objects in their world. So that's my basic approach, really to try to get to know them. And in the relational cultural model, there's a term called fluid expertise, that the expertise flows between the two of us. It's fluid. Mm. I might be more the expert on this, but you're more the expert on that. Mm. And I will do a lot of what has helped you in the past. You've been in treatment in the past. What helped you there? What didn't help you there? And really have them help me develop what we're going to be doing together. Mm. It has to be based on respect. And too often women who do go to treatment programs feel, as they are, you know, grouped together with the younger women, where sometimes you need to be a little bit more authoritative. If you're dealing with 18-year-olds, you do have to be a little bit more direct. Mm-hmm. So if you are in groups where that's the tone, that's not going to feel very good to you if you're a 45-year-old woman who actually has done a lot with her life and has made lots of decisions and really should be treated with respect and gravitas.
Mm-hmm. So, and I just thought of another question listening to you talk about that. You know, there's always the question of, you know, can someone who's in recovery themselves be a better treatment provider than someone who hasn't had an eating disorder? And I'm wondering, for our listeners who are middle-aged or older, is it better, or there may not be an answer, for them to have a provider who is older as well and who's been through some of those same life experiences?
I think if you're in treatment with someone who has a good recovery from an eating disorder, that can be a really good experience. But I don't think you have to have someone who's recovered. I've never had an eating disorder, and I think I understand them pretty well. Now, I have some very close friends who are also very prominent in the field who have had eating disorders, and I don't know that they understand, you know, they understand some aspects of it better than I do, like the actual experience, but I think when push comes to shove, we're probably equally effective with our patients because of our ability to say, I know my experience, but I need to know your experience. Mm-hmm. And I think the other thing that's really important is that even though I've never had an eating disorder, I'm a woman living in this culture, you know? There are some things that we all have to deal with in terms of the pressure on us around our bodies and what we are taught constantly about what we need to do in order to succeed. And it's always, you know, it always involves appearance and manufacturing the perfect shape and the perfect image and how we each navigate that. So even without an eating disorder, I think we have had to do that in order to get through So I think also having a feminist orientation of really wanting to support women and recognize their strengths and how the playing field is often unfair for women in our culture, that's an important thing in any therapist, to understand the impact of gender and how it still plays out. We want to think that we've come a long way, baby, but we have in some ways, but we still, you know, women are 18% of Congress. We are yet to elect a woman president, although I'm hoping that we will. and women are far less represented in the boardrooms across the country and in leadership positions. We have some, and they're, the ones who are out there are wonderful, but we don't have enough. And we have to start seeing women have power in the world so that we can help other women feel like they can do that as well, that they can have power not just through their body and through their appearance.
Mm-hmm. Yes. I agree. So your new book, Pursuing Perfection, is it a revision of the body myth or an extension of it? Or?
Yeah, it's a revision with a lot of new material. Mm-hmm. One of the great things is that, you know, when I wrote The Body Myth, it came out in 2005, there was basically no research on adult women at that time. Even just general statistics about dieting mm-hmm. were lacking. Any of the statistics I had in The Body Myth basically were magazine surveys, they were population surveys. There was not any real clinical mm-hmm. good data. There is a growing amount of research, mm-hmm. And it's not as much as we need, but we have much better numbers. As I mentioned to you, the study that came out in 2012 that says that 13.3% of adult women over 50 have eating disorder symptoms at any moment in time. And we know now that a quarter of the admissions to eating disorder inpatient programs are women over the age of 45, mm. a quarter of them. And again, that's a low number because women aren't often able to mm-hmm. go off for treatment. So we're starting to have some real data to help us to talk about this problem. So I have, you know, I have all of that. And then really integrating the relational cultural approach and what we know about the mind, the neuroscience that feeds our approach to patients, integrating that, integrating more about what we've seen with patients who have gone through recovery. So there's a lot of new material in it, but it's basically a revision of the body myth. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of the old stuff is there. Mm-hmm. And I think I'm focusing more in this book on the general theme of pursuing perfection, because I think that's such a struggle for women. That's what we mm-hmm. are fed all the time, that we have to change ourselves. We have to be better. We can never accept ourselves as we are in any dimension.
Mm-hmm. So I am thinking, you know, we are talking about a lot of the ways that that we're lacking in treatment resources and knowledge and, you know, across the nation. But if we were going to give some specific advice to someone who was older, you know, what would we say?
Mm-hmm. Well, the first thing we would say is do not give up.
Yeah.
And, you know, the other thing I do want people to understand is I and some of my friends have treated a lot of older women who do get better. They might come into treatment in their 40s, their 50s, their 60s, even their 70s, and they can actually make a lot of movement in their lives. Mm-hmm. So it is really possible to make the eating disorder much smaller and maybe even to leave it behind. Mm-hmm. We can't guarantee that, but we know we can make it smaller and that we can make their life force bigger. So that's the first thing I want women to understand. That they can have a better life. That it's not, they're not too old. And the second thing is to really work hard on finding someone who can meet your needs. Mm-hmm. It may not be the first five therapists that you call. And it may have to be, maybe it has to be a, you know, a cyber relationship with someone. Maybe that's what it has to be. Maybe there isn't anybody in your community or even in your state who is a good expert in treatment of adult women, but maybe you need to develop a group with other women. Maybe you need to develop a cyber group. There is always hope if you are willing to talk about your issues, come out of the darkness of the shame, and connect with other women. Eating disorders are disorders of disconnection. You disconnect from your body, from every life force in you. You disconnect from other people. And so the whole recovery is about reconnecting with yourself and with other people. So you can't do that alone. This is not something that is possible to do all by yourself.
I love that. As we are talking, and I was just thinking what you were probably going to answer. I was thinking about Women Who Run With the Wolves, Clarissa Estes, right?
Yeah.
And she has that chapter in there about the little duckling, I think, or the stork. It's the stork. And she just talks about how, you know, don't stop until you find your people or your pack. And yeah, that's what I thought.
Don't stop to find your pack. That's a good one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Knowing it's possible.
Yes,
yes. Yeah. Great. So do you have any thoughts about what our listeners could savor as they've just listened to this whole episode and they're winding down from all this information? What would be something you'd want to offer them to savor?
I would say to savor your life force. Mm. You have a life force inside you that is often diminished by all the pressures on you from everybody else, and that you need to start honoring it and savoring it.
Mm-hmm. Beautiful. Wonderful. Well, thank you again so much for being with us and sharing your knowledge and wisdom and time with us and our listeners. I think this is going to be a real special episode for them.
Yeah.
And Danielle, I'd like to just say it was an honor to have this with you. I remember meeting you many years ago.
Oh.
It's Marriage and Family Therapy Conference. You made a real impression on me.
Oh, wow.
And, so it's so wonderful to see you in, you know, in your ongoing professional role and all you're doing. So this is as much an honor for me as it is for
you. Oh, thank you so much.
Kelly, it was wonderful to meet you.
Thank you. Our listeners are so lucky. I hope they realize how lucky they are to have this episode. So thank you.